All right, guys, you are Locked On Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is a Fan/Film Friday where I will be answering your listener questions about what I saw on the All-22 film from the Falcons' Week 1 loss to the Seattle Seahawks.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Thanks to a lack of natural athleticism or commitment or overbearing sports parents, fewer than 1% of 1% of 1% of people will ever play professional football. But instead of entering the NFL, they've joined another league, the League of Football Watchers. This football season will be different, and Pepsi is here to get you ready for game day no matter how you watch, whether you're watching at home, social distancing at a sports bar, or tailgating by yourself in the parking lot of Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Pepsi is the refreshment you need to power through any game day. Because Pepsi isn't made for those who play the game, it's made for those who watch it. Pepsi, made for football watching. Go to madeforfootballwatching.com to check out the latest football watching content from Pepsi. So guys, you know me, I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years. You know me on Twitter, at FalcFans, being very snarky about the Atlanta Falcons. You can also check me out on this daily Atlanta Falcons podcast right here on the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. And today's episode is a Fan/Film Friday. Got to have the alliteration. It's a Q&A episode where I will be answering your listener questions. We already did a Q&A earlier this week on Wednesday, so definitely go check that out. But at that time, couldn't watch the All-22 and couldn't get into the normal Q&A film-related questions on that episode. All-22 finally dropped on Thursday, and so that means that we now have the opportunity to answer some of your more specific film-related questions that you guys submitted earlier in the week. Those include sort of assessing the sack responsibility in this week one game between the Falcons and Seahawks, and who was, attributed or should be attributed the credit for the 3 sacks by the Falcons as well as the 2 sacks by the Seahawks. The lack of adjustment that the Falcons had with Jamal Adams blitzing and whether that's a fair assessment. We'll talk about Dirk Koetter's usage of the outside zone blocking scheme. And we'll also get into why Dirk Koetter's offense and passing attack specifically doesn't quite look as good as it does when you watch other teams play. So those are going to be some of the topics that we get into, and sort of we'll jump into that first one, talking about the sack responsibility and breaking that down and what the film showed me as your Locked On Falcons lead story. So we got an email from Riley Strite. He asks, wondering if you can break down the sacks. For the sacks of Matt Ryan, who's at fault? And for the sacks of Russell Wilson, who was really to thank, for example, the back seven for their coverage, X player for clearing a hole on the stunt, or the actual person who got the sack for just getting the better of someone, etc. So Riley, we'll talk about the 3 sacks by the Falcons first. The first sack was from Tack McKinley in the first play of the game. And Tack basically came unblocked off the backside off a play action rollout, didn't bite on the run fake, and basically had a straight shot to Russell Wilson. Solid play by Tack. Very hungry for that first sack of the season, given that he wasn't necessarily allowed to eat anything all offseason as he was dropping weight. The second sack was on Grady Jarrett. Russell Wilson wanted to go for DK Metcalf, but AJ Terrell did a nice job sort of jumping that route and preventing Russell Wilson from pulling the trigger, which meant that he held onto the ball a little bit longer, which then allowed the stunt that Jarrett and Fowler ran on that particular play to work. Fowler crashed inside and Grady Jarrett went outside, made a tight loop around the right tackle and was able to get to Wilson. So you can attribute that sack somewhat to the coverage, AJ Terrell sort of taking away Russell Wilson's first read, and that sort of gave the stunt enough time it needed to work, but excellent work by Dante Fowler and Grady Jarrett up front. The third sack was the one split between Grady Jarrett and Dante Fowler. And this one is probably mostly on Russell Wilson. Since the Falcons were working in cover two in this play, Russell Wilson did have 2 open receivers on the right side of the field. He looked their way, but for whatever reason, didn't pull the trigger on either throw. And then he tried to work his way back with his progressions to the left side of the field. And by the time he did that, Grady Jarrett had been able to break through off of another stunt where he was working with Fowler. And even though Seattle kind of initially picked up the stunt pretty well, because Wilson held onto the ball for, at that point in time, about 4 seconds, which you guys know, on average, the ball is supposed to come out in like 2.5 seconds and under 3 seconds. That allowed Grady Jarrett enough time to get free, chase Wilson off his spot. By then, Fowler was able to come off of his block as well and sort of tag team with Grady Jarrett to get the half credit on the sack as well. Moving on to the sacks that the Falcons gave up to the Seahawks. The first one was a Jamal Adams sack. On this particular play, Seattle sugared the A-gaps, and what that means is they put both inside linebackers, Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, in the A-gap, lining up over Falcon center Alex Mack, and made it look like they were going to blitz. And that put six defenders on the line of scrimmage, and the Falcons had a six-man protection with three Seahawks to the left of Alex Mack and three Seahawks to the right of Alex Mack. And so the protection, as Alex Mack seemingly called it, was that the three to the left would be picked up by Jake Matthews, Matt Hennessy, and Mack himself. The three to the right would be picked up by Chris Lindstrom, Caleb McGarry, and Todd Gurley, the running back. But Jamal Adams walked up to the line of scrimmage late and thus wasn't accounted for in Mack's initial protection call. And so what ended up happening is at the snap, you had four guys on the right side and only three blockers, with Adams being that fourth guy. And then you had two guys on the left side dropping in the coverage, this being KJ Wright and Bruce Irvin. And so Mack and Hennessy had nobody to block. And then, you know, Bobby Wagner being on the right side was sort of let through by Alex Mack. Ty Gurley tried to pick him up. He didn't do a great job blocking him, but that was his assignment. And so because you had four rushers with three guys picking up their assignments, Adams was able to come free, was unaccounted for. So in that play, in order for the Falcons to correct that, and the ideally plan A would be Alex Mack would change the protection and allow it so that if those two guys on the left side dropped as they did, Mack would quickly make the adjustment, pick up Bobby Wagner, and that would allow Todd Gurley to pick up Jamal Adams. So you would have four blockers accounting for the four rushers on that side of the field. That didn't happen. Arguably, that would have been the most difficult thing to happen. So instead, plan B should have been, if Alex Mack wasn't going to change the protection at that point, Matt Ryan should have then noticed Jamal Adams walking up to the line of scrimmage and then changed the protection so that Adams would potentially be accounted for. That didn't happen as well. So then plan C would have been Matt Ryan saying, oh no, we have potentially a rusher that's unaccounted for in Jamal Adams. I need to make an adjustment on my hot read with this blitz coming because I'm going to have to get rid of the ball very, very quickly and make that adjustment. And Matt Ryan seemingly didn't on that particular play. So, you know, based off of his drop on that play, his pass drop on that play, it seemed like Matt Ryan wasn't expecting Adams to come. So that was a blown play by the Falcons with their protections. The second sack on Matt Ryan came on Bense Maoa on a fourth down attempt that the Falcons had in the red zone. The Falcons presented 21 personnel, meaning that there was a fullback on the field, and they played play action off of that, but they didn't really do a great job selling the fake. And it's somewhat understandable that you wouldn't in that situation, given it's a fourth down and the ball needs to come out quickly and you want to quickly get the conversion on that passing situation, that you don't necessarily waste time selling a run action in the backfield. But given that you put that personnel on the field, the whole point of you doing that is because you want to make Seattle think that you're running the football. So it's in your best interest to sell the fake at least better than what the Falcons wound up doing. They didn't do that. Keith Smith was a fullback released into the flat as a receiver. Todd Gurley, the running back, was in pass protection, picked up his blocker. It seemed like the design of the play with Russell Gage working out of the slot was to sort of settle into that middle zone behind the two linebackers, between the two linebackers and Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright. But because the Falcons didn't do a great job selling that fake, Bobby Wagner didn't really bite on the run action in the backfield, and so immediately dropped into the throwing lane, preventing that quick throw to Russell Gage. The other receivers, Keith Smith in this case, was well covered in the flat. Hayden Hurst ran a corner route into the end zone. He was also well covered. The third option was Julio Jones on the backside of the play, but you don't necessarily want your quarterback throwing across his body with bodies in his face. And the way that the Seahawks were able to generate the sack was they ran a stunt off that backside with Benson Mayoa, their edge rusher, twisting inside and was able to get past James Carpenter, who did not do a great job adjusting to that twist. And Mayoa was able to quickly chase down Matt Ryan, get the sack. And maybe if Carpenter had been done a better job picking up that stunt and at least slowing down Mayoa, Matt Ryan would have been able to extend the play outside the pocket and maybe buy Russell Gage more time to find settle into that soft spot in zone and potentially get a conversion. But unfortunately, that was not the case. So I hope that helps you, Riley, with the breakdown of the sacks. And there's your Locked On Falcons lead story. And we will move on and talk a little bit more about Jamal Adams and why he was so problematic and how and why the Falcons did or did not make the proper adjustments to deal with that problematic nature of him. But before we get there, I do want to plug the Locked On Hawks podcast hosted by Brad Rowland. NBA season is still going strong. The Hawks aren't in the playoffs, but there's still great content on the Locked On Hawks podcast hosted by Brad Rowland. You can find that, subscribe to it on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever you're listening to me right now. Visa knows that local businesses are the heartbeat of our communities. Whether they're our corner stores, our coffee spots, or our favorite shops, local businesses have always been there for us. They remember our orders. They call us by name, always giving back, making a difference, and going that extra mile to support us in our community. And right now, more than ever, local businesses need our support. So now it's time for us to return the favor. And the next time you go shopping, make the choice to shop at local businesses and look for the contactless symbol and tap to pay with contactless Visa to help support your community. Because where and how you shop matters. Visa, everywhere you want to be, official partner of the NFL. At JSama9, at Sama9J on Twitter, he asks, how many times Jamal Adams blitz without making adjustments? I don't think Jamal Adams blitzing was that problematic for the Falcons beyond the aforementioned sack play early in the game. The only other play that I noticed that seemed like Jamal Adams blitzing had a significant impact, and maybe I just missed a play or two or whatever in the middle of the game, but was at the end of the game on the play right before the Riley touchdown in the final minute of the game. And that was a play where Jamal Adams kind of blitzed from the secondary as a safety blitz, and it forced Matt Ryan to overthrow Russell Gage on sort of a corner route in the end zone. But I think similarly to the aforementioned sack, I think I put some of that on the quarterback more so than like the Falcons not adjusting. I think Matt Ryan could have made a better throw in that situation. I think the main thing with Adams was not that he was unaccounted for. It was just that he just made plays. And there were many times where the Falcons did account for him and tried to sort of sell him on run action and play fakes in the backfield that would normally freeze other players, but Adams never bought into those fakes and would just key on Ryan or key on the other ball carry and just make the play and disrupt those plays in the backfield. And that's what Dirk Koetter kind of meant when he was talking about sort of what Adams was able to do. And I think some people misinterpreted what he was saying. And I think some people interpreted it as saying like, oh, he's saying that they only expected Adams to blitz one time and he wanted to blitz in three times. But really what Dirk Koetter was saying is that Adams was able to make three sort of crazy plays off the backside based off of his physical ability. And what he was saying is in a normal NFL game, a normal NFL player would only be capable of making one of those plays, and Adams made three of them. And so basically what Koetter was saying was Adams is that good that he could make three times as many plays based off his physical ability that any normal NFL player could make. And essentially Dirk Koetter was 100% right in that assessment. So I don't think it was really Adams being unaccounted for and the Falcons not making adjustments. I just think Adams is that good. He's just really good at football. Our next question comes from Joshua Woods. He's asked, what were your thoughts on the running game? It seems like I saw more stretch plays, but there was definitely a healthy mix of power running. What was the breakdown? It is similar to last year or more stretch plays? I think I answered this question on Wednesday for Joshua, but now that I've watched the film, I can go into a little bit more detail. They did run a stretch play on the opening play. That was the only time they ran a stretch play in the entire game. They did run a couple of other outside zone runs on, particularly on their first two possessions. But after that, it was primarily duo runs, inside zone, power runs. You saw some draws and whatnot. They did run one crack toss, which is another staple outside zone run on, I think, their third possession. It was definitely progress compared to what we saw from Dirk Koetter last year, as I outlined in a podcast we did back in August, where I sort of broke down Dirk Koetter's game scripts from the first 15 plays last season and his treatment specifically in one of those episodes about the run game, and basically discovered or realized that until the final three or four games of the season, the Falcons almost never had any outside zone runs in their opening game scripts. Now, again, Dirk Koetter had some of those runs in this game, but quickly abandoned them after he got past the first 15 or so plays and went back to more of his tried and true runs that he also ran throughout last year. Now, I will say that I think some of those runs were more effective in the Seahawks game than they were for the most part last season. But I think it shows that basically when push comes to shove, Dirk Koetter reverted back to his old tried and true methods and didn't really incorporate outside zone into the offense beyond the first quarter of the game. And I think getting him to do that more is definitely a work in progress. So guys, we still have more questions. including one focusing on the passing game as far as Dirk Koetter sees it. But before we get there, I do want to plug the Locked On NFL podcast and their Friday recap of the Thursday night game between the Cleveland Browns and Cincinnati Bengals. Your boy Q of Locked On Raiders and Bo Brack of Locked On Cardinals will get you all caught up on Thursday night action. They'll also get you set for this weekend's week two action on your favorite podcast platform. Subscribe to Locked On NFL podcast on Apple, Spotify, or whatever you're listening to me right now. So maybe you were too busy last night to catch the Browns and Bengals game. Don't worry, because NFL Game Pass has you covered. You can catch every snap from every game with full game replays, revisit the All-22 with the coaches film to review Koetter's offense on your own time. And if you don't have that time to watch an entire game, then all you need is 45 minutes to see every snap with the condensed version of the game. You'll also learn from the league's best players with over 40 NFL Game Pass film sessions, so you can see exactly why Jamal Adams is such a beast. And you can also check out Amari Cooper, Eddie Jackson, and get you inside the player's perspective as those guys break down the concepts and techniques that make them some of the best in the business, to see why those types of playmakers that the Falcons will be facing over the next couple of weeks will potentially be impactful. And you can get it all by going to NFL.com/Game Pass to start your free trial today. NFL Game Pass, where football never stops. So our final question comes from Keith Guillory at KG Tell the World on Twitter. He asks, why does every passing play seem so tough for the Falcons? Watching the Steelers last night, it seems like they ran picks, option routes, and other schemes to get Julio, or I'm sorry, whenever I see Juju, I think who? Juju in space. Everything for Atlanta seems highly contested since Shanahan left. Yes, I think you're right, Keith. I part of this, I've gone on these rants many times before, so I'll just sort of hit, I'll play the hits, right? Koetter runs a relatively vanilla offense. It doesn't feature a lot of motion, and the primary reason why you want to use motion in today's NFL is it's going to sort of force the defense to dictate whether they're in man and zone, which is going to make the reads easier on the quarterback. And Koetter's offense doesn't feature that many complementary route combinations, some of which what you're referring to with Juju Smith-Schuster, where you're looking for one receiver's route is going to pull coverage away from another receiver's route and open up windows and throwing windows, easy throwing windows for quarterbacks to throw into. Now, I can't speak to the exact nature of the Steelers' offense because it's not something I've studied in depth, but I imagine of what a lot of Pittsburgh does with Juju, given that he's their number one receiver and spends the majority of his snaps in the slot, you generally have to work a little harder if you want to run your offense through a slot receiver and not just have him run a bunch of quick 5 to 8 yard routes. So I think that's also facilitating why the Steelers are maybe a little bit more creative with how they utilize Juju Smith-Schuster. Now, to be fair to Dirk Koetter, the Falcons do use picks. They do use rubs. They do use some of this stuff. A lot of Russell Gage's catches in week one came off of picks and in more complimentary routes, usually with Julio Jones or Hayden Hurst sort of helping him get open on some of those plays. That stuff does exist in the Koetter offense, but the problem is that when push comes to shove, and similar to what we're talking about where, when push comes to shove with Koetter in the run game, he's going to revert back to his old tried and true tactics in the run game. In the passing game, Dirk Koetter is going to revert back to asking his wide receivers to beat man coverage. And that's not inherently terrible in itself, especially when you have playmakers like Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley at the position. But I think that would work much more effectively if you mix that in with a healthy mix of shot plays and more of those complementary route combinations. And you could call those types of plays regardless. If you had those types of plays regularly featured in your playbook, you could almost call them regardless of who is on the field. And that's what you're talking about with Kyle Shanahan, that you saw this in 2016, even in games like the Rams game and the 49ers game that particular season, where Julio Jones missed both of those games, Sanu missed the Rams game. You didn't see the Falcons stop being explosive in those games because they were able to dial up shot plays with Aldrick Robinson, with Taylor Gabriel, with other players. And it didn't really matter the quality of receiver on your field because the offense is the offense, right? Now, obviously, when you have players like Sanu and Julio and Ridley, etc., if you have those guys healthy, your offense is going to be even better than it would be when you have guys like Robinson and Gabriel and Justin Hardy. And so in the Koetter offense, he does have shot plays, but the offense isn't as geared towards regularly generating those plays as the Shanahan offense was. It's not as intentional with Koetter's offense as it was with Shanahan. That was one of the biggest differences that I often complained about, particularly in 2017, between the difference between what Shanahan did in 2016 and Sark. Sark didn't have that intentionality in his offense when it came to dialing up shot plays. When the Falcons got explosive plays that in that particular season, a lot of it was just the individual receiver on the Falcons making a play, right? Whether that was after the catch or whatever the case it was. And you also saw that with Dirk Koetter when he gave up play calling duties with Todd Monken in 2018 in his final year in Tampa Bay. And that was one of the reasons why I said, if the Falcons are going to hire, you know, a Tampa Bay Buccaneers play caller back, you know, saying this back in January 2019, the guy that they should have hired was Todd Monken, because Todd Monken had a much more intentionality when it came to dialing up explosive plays. And that's why you saw this big jump for the Bucs offense from 2017 to 2018. And you saw this again last year with the Bucs offense with Bruce Arians, who also has an offense that's geared towards generating explosive plays. And you need that in today's NFL. For those of you that, you know, haven't heard me talk about this before, I've been talking about it on this podcast in various incarnations of this podcast for like 6-7 years. But explosiveness really matters when it comes to offense, because when you look at offenses that generate explosive plays on a regular basis, in the data I have seen, the research I have done, when you look at a drive that includes a 20 plus or 25, 35, 40 yard play in it, the chances of you getting into the red zone, getting into scoring position, go up like 4 or 5 times than it would be if you don't have one of those plays, right? The chances of you scoring, you know, being able to move the field, move the ball down the field, whether you're getting in the red zone or not, the chance of you scoring on one of those drives goes up 4 or 5 times. You're generating 4 or 5 times as many points per drive when you're getting those explosive plays on average. What you really want to be able to do is be able to move, you know, 75, 80 plus yards down the field in 5, 6, or 7 plays, which is often going to include some explosive plays, whether that is a 17 yard throw, a 19 yard throw, a 29 yard throw, or 27 yard throw, or whatever. You need those in your offense. And the best offenses in today's NFL have that. And that was a regular part of why the Shanahan offense was so effective, because oftentimes when we talk about that intentionality in the offense, you know, you're talking about Shanahan would call plays where he would present a look to a defense, read what that look was, and then later in the game present that same look, and then attack how that defense defended that initial look and say, okay, you defended this with cover two. Well, now we're going to show it again, and we're going to throw a cover two beater at you, and we're going to generate an explosive play and put our offense in favorable situations. And you just didn't have that with Steve Sarkisian. You didn't really have that with Dirk Koetter. And, you know, the one thing you can say about Steve Sarkisian is that he started to use Calvin Ridley as sort of that explosive playmaker in the offense in 2018. And that's why you saw a jump in the, at least in the first half of the season, in terms of generating those explosive plays. And then once Ridley sort of hit the rookie wall midway through the season, you saw the offense kind of struggle, which is why they went on that, 5-6 game losing streak. But then they kind of got it back, in part due to Mohamed Sanu generating some of those explosive plays, being that sort of number two guy beyond Julio Jones down the stretch in that season. And so that's been one of the reasons why I've been so keen on, oh, the Falcons need to unlock the full potential of Calvin Ridley, because you need to have that other playmaker that generates explosive plays. And the problem with the Dirk Koetter offense is, by and large, it has been an offense that has primarily relied on Julio Jones to generate those explosive plays. And without that, you know, complementary playmaker, you know, this offense becomes infinitely easier to defend, because you can, relatively speaking, it's easier to limit Julio Jones' explosive plays because whoever's covering him is getting safety help. So there's my rant, you know, the 15,000th rant I've gone on why Dirk Koetter's offense. It's, you know, it's not that Koetter's offense is a bad offense. It just has a lower ceiling because you're not generating explosive plays on a regular basis. And the offense isn't really looking for those. It's more just looking for, you know, kind of this dink and dunk sort of style of offense, which is hard to sustain in today's NFL, particularly against quality defenses who are going to wind up getting stops on third downs. And when you don't have an elite offensive line, which I think is fair to question if the Falcons have that, it's going to be even harder to sustain that type of offense long term. So I don't know if I really answered your question, Keith, but you know, those are the sort of the general thoughts on why the Falcons offense seems to struggle so much and whatnot. So there you guys have it. I hope you enjoyed today's Fan Friday. You know, my opinion of the game by and large didn't change. you know, I certainly think the coaching staff with their game plan, particularly on defense, made things easy for Russell Wilson. I think the coaching staff, in terms of Dirk Cutter's play calling, while I think he showed progress in incorporating more Shanahan-esque plays into his play calling, you didn't see that as sort of a through line throughout the entire game. It just kind of, they kind of abandoned it, you know, in the, after the first quarter. And, you know, I don't think the coaching staff did a great job. As I've said, I think they're more than ripe for criticism. I just think that even despite the fact that the Falcons arguably, I mean, it's an easy argument to make, got outcoached in this game, I still think there were, you know, roughly like, say, 8 opportunities for this team to get back into this game and at least make it a competitive game that potentially could have gone down to the final possession and given this team a chance to win the game. But I think really those situations, those 8 opportunities, players didn't execute. And unfortunately for the Falcons, they didn't execute on like any of those 8 opportunities, and the Seahawks did. And I think had the Falcons been able to execute on maybe 3 or 4 of those opportunities, as I said, I think they would have had a chance to win this game, despite the fact that they didn't have a great game plan and they got outcoached by the Seahawks. And I think this is ultimately the issue the Falcons are going to have to deal with all season, is that there, it's going to be rare instances where you ever say the Falcons outcoach their opposing team. That's never really been their MO. It hasn't really been their MO really since 2016, when Kyle Shanahan was the guy sort of facilitating them outcoaching other other teams. They've never been a team that's outcoached teams on defense. That's rare instances where you say they had a brilliant game plan and they caught everything the opposing team did. Most of the time when you see games where it looks like the Falcons dominate on defense, it's because the opposing team, I can think of the Dallas game against the Cowboys in 2017, where the opposing offense has a even more vanilla scheme than what we're talking about with Dirk Cutter, with Jason Garrett had in that Dallas game. And, you know, again, Dirk Cutter's not really gearing his play calling to attack specific aspects of opposing defenses. And so you're not really getting the sort of out scheming. So there's not going to be very many instances. And that's why, you know, I continue to stress and stress throughout the offseason and have stressed in recent years why when people talk about this team's talent level, it's overrated, because like they don't have the level of talent that people like to hype them up to say that they have, where they can just simply go out there and execute perfectly and just out execute every team in the league or most of the teams in the league. They don't have that talent level. That's why I sit here and say like talent is overrated, at least as the way that Falcon fans talk about it. Talent matters, but it's the Falcons' talent level has been vastly overrated by fans and media, thinking that you can basically play like, what talent is basically you can play vanilla and win football games that way. And that's a big reason why the Cowboys never were good under Jason Garrett. They were always an 8-8 sort of team because they had all this talent, but their offense and their defense were, you know, oftentimes very, very vanilla. And it just, it doesn't result in success at this level of league. You, the parity between teams is just too strong where you can't, it's not like an LSU going up against Northwestern where the talent level is just, you know, maybe that's not fair to Northwestern because they've come a long way. Maybe Purdue is a better school to use. You know, I don't, you know, I'm sure there's like one Purdue listener like, hey man, don't crap on the Boilermakers. But, you know, like you don't have that talent level, you know, LSU versus Alabama, A&M, like you have in college football, where there's a clear disparity of talent level. You don't have that in the NFL, and that's where coaching really does matter. That's, you know, I get why people are critical of the coaching staff, but like this is kind of how the Falcons are. And going back to what I was, you know, the point I was trying to make is that's why I kept harping on they need to get better players. They need to invest more talent. And this faith that they have in the Vic Beasleys and the Damante Kazees and the Foye Olukuns and the Charles Harrises and the Isaiah Olivers, I don't think it's going to help them out. And it's ultimately, I think, going to wind up getting them fired. And that's why, you know, I was constantly harping for the team to do more and do more and do more, trade back, get more talent in the draft, invest more in free agency and all these various things, not waste all their money on average players that aren't going to really improve the talent level, that are just stopgap options like they've done several times over the last couple of off seasons on the offensive line, et cetera. So not to rehash all those old arguments, but that's, you know, ultimately where it comes down to. And so I think this team is ultimately going to win when they execute. And we can certainly talk about this coaching staff's ability to get this team to execute on a consistent level. And that's been a big problem. And that to me, you know, not to say that their scheming, their vanilla scheming is not an issue, but like that ship has sailed. You're not going to get that to change that much. Maybe we'll get Raheem Morris to do a little bit better job. I still have a little bit of hope that Raheem Morris can mix things up and be a little bit more exotic with some of the looks that he's going to present to teams. But with Dirk Koetter, you know, you're not going to teach an old dog new tricks is basically what I'm getting at. And so you really do need this team to execute at a high level. And I think that's ultimately going to decide whether or not they win. And again, with this coaching staff's history, we haven't consistently, certainly the last couple of years, we haven't consistently got this team executing at a high level. And so that's where you can really question the coaching staff, whether or not they're capable of coaching up all these young, talented, athletic players that they keep insisting to us are going to, you know, have these breakout seasons if we can just, you know, get them right. And we'll see. Again, not closing the door on the season by any means, but certainly the week one action didn't inspire a lot of confidence that much has changed. But then again, to be fair to the Falcons, we've seen this story play out many times in week one where they're ill prepared for that week one game. That's basically been the through line since 2015. That was the last time they looked prepared for a week one game. And we'll see if they can bounce things back in week two. And if they can, then that can, you know, we can wash this bad taste out of our mouth. If they don't and they get into an 0-2 hole and we see some of the same issues, yeah, we might be in for a long season, guys. But we'll see. Only time will tell, right? So I appreciate you guys tuning in. We'll be back on Sunday evening with a rapid reaction. That episode will probably be posted 7 or 8 p.m. Eastern time on Sunday. If you can't catch it then, of course, you can always catch it Monday morning as well. So we will give you that rapid reaction on whatever happens on Sunday's action between the Cowboys and Falcons. And of course, check out NFL Game Pass and also check out Visa and drink your Pepsi. Until then, guys.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.